Welcome to Dollars and Cents, Wealth, Wisdom, and Well-Being, where we delve into fascinating topics with amazing people, thought leaders, and trailblazers from all walks of life. I'm John Carolyn, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager for Main Street Wealth Management Group. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Mark Lopez, Senior Vice President, Olympic silver medalist, and certified financial planner for the team. And today, we're honored to welcome Carrie Holman Westbrook, a visionary in the field of family law. Her firm is Holman Westbrook Law, which is located here in Houston, Texas. Carrie, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Very good to be here today with you guys.
Well, everybody has a story, and we can't wait to hear more about yours.
All right, Carrie. Well, we always like to start each episode with some fun facts or trivia. So here's a question for you and our listeners. Which high-profile entrepreneur finalized his divorce in 2019, leading to one of the largest divorce settlements in history, involving shares of a global tech giant?
I know it's Jeff Bezos. I wasn't sure of the settlement, but I was thinking it was in like the $200 million range.
Oh my gosh. You got one correct, and the second one's a little bit off.
The amount awarded to his ex-wife was $38 billion. That's with a B, everybody. Billion, $38 billion.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think that after the settlement, that made her the third richest woman in the world.
Well, she married well.
She did all right. Well, so let's rewind to the start of your story, Carrie. Can you tell us about where you grew up and the experiences that shaped you?
Yes, I grew up in East Texas, Northeast Texas, kind of near Dallas. It's a little town called Jacksonville. You may know it as the tomato capital of Texas.
I did not know that.
Yes. I think it was my sister and my cousin were Miss Tomato Fest one year.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
Very small town. I think back then, like maybe 13,000 people. I think it's grown to maybe 14, 15 now. So, yeah, getting pretty big.
It's a metropolis.
Yes. So I usually just tell people I'm from Tyler because nobody knows where Jacksonville is. But I was born there and raised there. My family's from there for three generations back, and my parents are still there and a lot of, you know, extended families there. So yeah, it was a cool place to grow up, a little tiny town. Everybody knew everybody, kind of that typical small town, what you would expect, Friday night lights, all that stuff was a big deal. So after college, I went to SFA in Nacogdoches, which isn't too far, like 45 minutes. So I didn't stray far. And then after I decided to be a school teacher, I came down to Houston and got my first job in the Houston area in Pearland. So I was teaching school for a couple of years before I went to law school.
What subject did you teach?
I taught pre-AP language arts and some English classes, but mainly just language arts classes. So it was eighth grade, and those kids were very interesting. I think I was only 21, so it's probably a little too young to be teaching kids that are a little older because it was kind of a hard, you had to be, I guess, stricter than normal just because I wasn't that much older than those kids were back then. So it was fun for a couple of years, but decided to go back to school and do something different, different direction.
Cool. Awesome. Awesome. Well, everyone has that person or people who've left a mark on their life. Who is that for you, and how do they help guide your path to where you are today?
I think what I thought about this a lot. I think that I came up with my grandfather. His name was Lumen Holman, and he also grew up in the town where I was from, and so I was close to him growing up. He only passed away a couple of years ago at the ripe old age of 100, almost made it to 101, but just one of those people that you've always looked up to when you were young. He did a lot of things, even though he was from a small town. He ran a business, and he was very active in some organizations like Kiwanis and things of that sort, a lot of the community give-back type of organizations. Mm-hmm. And he was big in the Federal Land Bank. He spoke in Washington several times and just did a lot of cool stuff in his life, and so I always looked up to him. He was a good orator. He kind of taught himself, taught how to speak in front of large groups because he started doing that as he got older. I think my grandmother helped him learn to speak and do well in front of crowds. And so I always admired that about him, just coming from kind of humble beginnings. So,
okay.
Yeah. That, a lot of people, they say that that's one of the most terrifying things to do is to
speak in public. Oh, yeah. I think it's like the number one fear of most adults is speaking in front of people.
That's incredible. Learning that later in life. It's interesting to see you talking that he was 100, 101?
100 years old. He would have been 101 about 3 months after he passed. So
we were just talking about, and Mark especially talks more and more about longevity. And I think it's just so interesting when you're talking about the things that help people live longer, staying active with the community, keeping busy. And it seems like a relatively low stress.
I think that's the number one thing. First of all, stress, because I think that's killing all of us because that just takes you out quick. But for him, he was that person that stayed active. And when he would get up every day, put his suit on, his hat, and go to the office, even when he was 98, 99, and he would just open mail. He didn't work. He wasn't doing the typical work that he had done before, but he would open his mail. He would, you know, correspond with people, have my mom type a letter for him, you know, just little things, but he kept busy.
Oh,
so
that's sweet.
I feel like that's what keeps you going for a long time.
Amen.
And as a follow-up question, what influenced you or who or what influenced you to get into family law?
So family law, I always sort of joke, is it sort of chose me. I didn't choose it because if you ask family law attorneys, they'll tell you no one in their right mind would actually choose family law because it's not for the faint of heart. But I went through my love-hate relationship with family law over my career because it can be a very difficult area. It's stressful, obviously very emotional. It's a difficult, can be a difficult area. But I basically determined several years back that this was obviously where I'm meant to be because every time I would try to kind of go a different path, it would suck me back in like the mob. So I ended up staying here. But I really came to reconcile it with, look, this is just my mission field. I'm meant to be in this place. I'm meant to help people in the probably the worst times of their lives. I mean, I equate it to a death in the family. It's just as difficult on people, if not harder, than when someone, when they lose their spouse or their loved one. So I've just kind of embraced it as I'm here. This is my mission field. I'm here to help how I can. Some days I feel like I succeed in that. Sometimes I feel like I don't, but you know, I've still pushed through and stick with it.
Wow.
And as a follow-up to that, I know you work with both men and women. Is there particular advice or something that you would give as words of advice to men in particular, and then something different to women?
Yes, I think, you know, I'll talk in terms of sort of the main issues I see with each gender. And of course, this is generalizations because there's exceptions to every role. But obviously, in our society still, most of the men tend to be more breadwinners than the women, not all the time, but that's the more common scenario that I see. So I usually recommend to my male clients to always have a prenup. Because even if you're just starting out and you don't have a lot of assets yet, you can limit things like your temporary attorney's fees, your temporary spousal support, and your post-divorce support or your post-divorce division of assets. Obviously, it's for that too. But what sometimes actually costs people as much as even the division of assets is just while the case is pending, because you can be required to pay all of your spouse's bills and expenses, plus your own bills and expenses while the case is going on, if that's kind of been your status quo. So if you have a stay-at-home wife, you're going to tend to be ordered to continue that status quo, but yet it isn't status quo because you're required usually to move out of the house. So you just took one set of living expenses and made it double, but you've got to still pay the same level that you were paying before. That isn't always the case. It varies case to case, of course, and depends on the finances. But in general, the court can order things like that. And that money, if you think about paying that for 6, 8, 12 plus months while your case is pending, plus potentially having to also pay your spouse's some portion of attorney's fees, that can add up to a lot of money that you could avoid with a prenup. So that's, and you know, I'll say prenup. It's technically in Texas, we call them either premarital agreements or postmarital agreements. But everybody knows prenup from Kanye West, so I use that term.
And is there anything that you would generally say to women?
For women, I just like to really impress upon them the importance of knowing where the bodies are buried. So in other words, just at least know where his accounts are, even if, frankly, a lot of men don't like to tell their wives, I have $400,000 in the 401k. They don't want to tell their wives or don't share that information, which first of all, I lecture my female clients that it's your money too, so you need to know that information. But even if he's not forthright, you need to know, hey, I know it's with Fidelity. I don't know how much is in it, but I know that's who administers it. Or I know that I've got that he banks at Chase, or I know he banks at Wells Fargo. At least know what institutions that he tends to use, because even if you can't get the information, I can subpoena it and find it if I know where to go looking. But otherwise, it's just impossible. It's a needle in a haystack problem. So I try to impress upon them to try to figure out where the basic assets are, or at least what they are, so that we can start to dig around and get that information when we go through the divorce process. The court has to divide everything, so we have to know what it is. There's requirements around sharing that information during the case, but the more that you know before you go in, the less expensive it is, because you're not having to pay me to go do, you know, a wild goose chase trying to find the information.
That makes a lot of sense. And kind of going back to, you know, we focus a lot on education. And so clients of ours, we encourage, it should be the husband and the wife to come in, because statistically speaking, the husband's going to pass away first or go away first, right? You know, just looking at life expectancy. And so some of the clients that we have that require the most handholding are the ones that didn't have that education. And when I mean education, I just mean knowing where things are, knowing where the passwords are, who to call in the event that something happens. And you made a really good, you tied divorce and the death of a spouse, because I could see how they could be equally traumatic.
Yes, absolutely. And the same is true. Even if your spouse passes away, you need to know where things are to be able to figure out how everything's supposed to be getting divided up or moved around as needed. So that's the thing that I find shocking sometimes, that people just, I think it overwhelms people. I mean, I'm sure you see this in your line of work. They just sort of bury their head in the sand because they're overwhelmed or afraid to look at it in the face. They don't really understand it, and they just kind of avoid it and don't think about it.
Because it's such a sensitive topic, and just bringing up a prenup, what did you call it? A premarital agreement. Is there a right way and a wrong way to bring it up? I guess there is.
I think I find the best way to talk about it with the significant other, is to talk about it in terms of protecting both parties, because it really does. And sometimes even for the person who's not the breadwinner in their relationship, they could use that to be able to get certain things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise get. So it doesn't always have to be to divest someone of something they should be entitled to. It might be to give them something that they wouldn't have received. I've had people negotiate all kinds. I mean, you can basically negotiate just about anything in those agreements. So you can say, hey, if you have an adulterous affair, I want $100,000 liquidated damage. I mean, you can add all kinds of things in there. So it doesn't have to be that you're just, it's, I think the traditional idea in a lot of people's heads is, well, he's trying to bully me out of my money and he's going to make me sign this and I get nothing. And that's really not the case. You can negotiate it to be different. And if both parties can come to some agreements around what they think is fair, and what I find is really the law, most people don't think is fair when it comes down to dividing things. Most people actually don't like it. They would rather do it a different way, but because the courts do it a certain way, it kind of tends to go that route. So why not be in control of your own financial picture and what you and your own spouse or significant other would prefer versus what the law is going to force upon you in the event something happens? And that's really more the idea of it in my mind, is to be in control of your own financial future, in the same with your children or whatever it may be. Those decisions are best made by you and him, not by some judge that's sitting up here that you get to talk to for, if you're lucky, 30 minutes, that knows nothing about your situation.
Yeah, either way, there's an agreement in place. And like you said, it's whether you and your spouse want to create that agreement amongst each other, or it's forced upon you by the court, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And then would you recommend like a newlywed couple to go see the same attorney, or each of them have their separate attorneys?
You have to use separate attorneys. In our area of law, or my area of law, we have such a high potential for it being a conflict of interest that you typically would always use a separate attorney. For postmarital and premarital agreements, you absolutely have to use a separate attorney. And in fact, it could get tossed out if you don't do that, because the judge might feel, or somebody attacked that agreement down the line and said, I didn't feel this was fair. He went to his old-time family attorney and brought me in and made me sign. I didn't think I had a choice. So I always, in fact, will encourage my clients to pay for an attorney for the other person, to have a completely separate neutral person to look at the agreement with that client separately, talk to them about it, because generally speaking, these things hold water as long as you draft them correctly, but they can be set aside. I mean, they're not ironclad if you don't do it the right way. And one of those ways that it could be set aside is if you use the same attorney. So you don't really ever want to do that, and you want to give the other spouse or the other party time to have it reviewed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess the same thing goes with, you were saying that usually in your experience, the man's the breadwinner. But if the situation is reversed, it's equally as important, right?
Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it could even be a situation where you receive, let's say your parents pass away and there's a large inheritance you receive, or there's other things of that sort. Not necessarily something you planned when you were getting married 20 years ago. And now you're looking at this divorce and you're thinking, wow, I have this inheritance. What do I do with this? But a good postmarital or premarital agreement can kind of address any of those potentials that may be out there. And generally speaking, your inheritances are what they call separate property. So that would not necessarily be subject to being divided like your community property is in a divorce. However, there's all kinds of convoluted issues that come up with inheritances, because most people who get an inheritance, what's the first thing they do? They pay off their house, which potentially is a community asset. So now you've paid off with separate property money a community asset that causes all kinds of problems, where we have to sort of parse all that out at the end.
Now that is, so that's really interesting.
It gets very complex when that kind of stuff goes on.
It gets commingled.
It gets commingled.
Commingling. That's the word I was looking for.
And you can trace it out, but I've had people have to pay tracing experts $7,500, $10,000, $15,000 just to figure out where all the money went and whose was what and when did they get it and where did it originate from? Was it separate or community? Those cases get very complicated and cost a lot of money. Whereas if you had had all of that already lined out in a document, think how much money you're saving, because it's at least would limit some of that. You might still have to trace it out to figure out what's what, but it would at least eliminate some of the litigation over how it's going to be split at the end.
You probably ran into all sorts of different situations, a given division of assets. And one that we hear is a question for you, really, is, have you seen it where one spouse or the other spouse, they're dividing the assets up, and let's say they give, I don't want to call it a trick, but give somebody like high cost basis stock while they keep something that's going to be less or more tax friendly to them? I mean, what sort of things have you seen like that?
Yes, that's very common, because if you don't get an attorney that is well versed in those tax consequences of the division of different types of assets, then you can really get one over on the other attorney big time. I mean, if I know that it may look like it's $100,000 in the account, but she's going to get hit with 45% taxes on that, I'm not going to keep that account. I'm going to keep the pre-tax IRA over, or the Roth IRA over here, where I've already paid that. So there's different ways, different assets are, you know, it's apples to oranges. So you really have to think about that. I have a lot of people that will propose, because traditionally most women want the house more so than most men. More often the woman would prefer to stay in the home, whereas a lot of times the men would prefer to keep their retirement. So it's a common sort of horse trading thing going on, where you're saying, well, you're keeping the equity in the house, and so I'm going to keep my retirement. Well, you have to think about, is that apples to apples? Because, you know, if you sell the home, you may pay some commissions or whatnot, but it may not be the same as getting a 401k, where if I try to tap into that underage, I'm going to get hit with 25-30% plus have to pay on taxes. So those are the types of things that an attorney has to talk to you about, those intricacies, because it's very different depending on which type of asset you're talking about.
It sounds to me like you spend a lot of time being educating your clients. That's important.
Yes. And I still feel like, I mean, I've done this going on 22 years now, and I still have to go look at stuff and reread stuff or call. And I always also caution people, talk to your accountant, your CPA, your financial planner, because there's aspects of things that I'm not going to be thinking about as a family attorney. I'm focused on this sort of bird's eye view, bigger picture, more so than some of those little nuances that you guys, you professionals are going to know. So it really takes kind of a team of people to have around to get these cases done effectively so that you've got advice on all fronts and you can make the best decisions.
Well, we appreciate the information you've already given us. It's pretty eye-opening, and I'm sure our listeners are appreciating the advice that you're giving us. But an important question before we continue, are you going to be charging us for any of this advice?
I'll give you guys a discount, right, just this
you.
Once.
Thank you. But is there something in your industry or what you do that you find people might misinterpret or don't understand about your practice?
I think the biggest misconception that I see, aside from things that are custody issues, so I feel like today I'm sticking more on sort of the financial side of the assets and debts, but in terms of the assets and debts side of what I do, the biggest misconception is what community property is. I have it all the time where people come in and say, well, my checking account only has my name on it, so why can my husband get half of it? And I said, because it's a community asset. I mean, that is the point of the community property laws, is it makes everything all in the same community pot, even if it's separate names. So I have women come in and say, well, the house is in his name, the car's in his name, the 401k is in his name. I'm going to get nothing. I'm going to be penniless on the street. And I'm saying, no, that's all community property. He may think it's his, but it's not. It's half yours or more sometimes than half. So that is the most common misconception that I still see a lot, is people think that if they put it in a certain name or they hold it a certain way, that it's not going to be community. And I've used that Jeff Bezos example a million times. And I've told people, someone like him, who has all the money in the world, had to pay that large of a settlement, don't think that you're going to trick the judge. Don't go selling your truck to your uncle for $4 and think that's going to get, you know, pass the smell test, because it's not going to happen. There's a reason that he had to pay that much, and that's because these laws are fairly set in stone in terms of what the judge does to make sure both people come away with something.
Wow. It's fascinating, and it is really important advice. It's something that I think that people don't necessarily think enough about. And certainly, I think people will appreciate learning more about it and just being educated, and it's never too late to educate yourself on those matters.
And I think, you know, a lot of people don't understand that debts work in a similar fashion, because those are also community. So he's run a business for 20 years and he hasn't been paying his taxes. Well, that's all issues that we have to figure out in the divorce, because that stuff can't be left hanging out there. If she's run up credit cards and gone shopping like mad and she's got all this credit card debt, don't just assume she's going to be paying all of that. That may be something that, you know, the court's ordering you to help pay part of, even if you didn't necessarily know how much was out there. There's exceptions to everything I'm saying, because everything is not black and white, or I wouldn't really need to be. I probably wouldn't have a job if it was that cut and dried. But the debts are a big one, too, that people don't realize.
Wow. Let me ask you, you know, you obviously you're passionate about what it is that you do. What's the main thing that you think drives you in your work? What gets you up in the morning, let's say, ready to conquer the day?
Mostly, I've come to, as I said, I kind of fought my demons with it for a while, where I was like, oh, I'm so burnt out with this and that. And I did have to sort of set some boundaries for myself. I think that in this line of work, there's people that call you Friday night when you're trying to eat dinner with your family at, you know, 9 o'clock at night. People call you Saturday morning. People call you 24/7, demanding your time and attention right then and there, because whatever's going on to them feels like it's the end of the world. It very rarely is. I've learned to draw those boundaries and just kind of say, I can call them back on Monday. It's not going to be the end of the world. But that took me a lot of years to get to that point. So I think these days what keeps me moving is I have had to set those realistic expectations. Whereas younger in my career, I'm trying to burn up the woods and be the best attorney ever. And I didn't realize that that would actually burn me out. And it can be somewhat of this vampire effect where you are getting sucked dry every day. You got to just take a step back. So that was something that I learned to do for self-preservation, to be able to keep going in this field. Because most attorneys you'll see in my field, they move into other fields. They don't stay in family law their whole careers because it burns too many people out.
Well, I can imagine. It's such an emotional thing. And not only do you have to play the role as attorney, educator, and counselor. I mean, you must find yourself doing a lot of kind of like a psychiatrist.
It really is. And I've had to really gently and kindly tell a few clients, I am happy to talk to you about this, but you can get a counselor for way lower hourly rate than what you're paying me. So I do always, in fact, try to encourage my clients to get that support on the psychological side. Because as I mentioned, I do feel like going through these is like a death in the family, and you really need that support. Most of my clients, when they go through these, I really do say it's like temporary insanity. They cannot focus at work. They have trouble making decisions. And it's just very hard. And then right in the middle of that, they're called upon to make these huge decisions about everything. What are you going to agree? What are you going to accept in your financial future? What are you going to accept with your children? What's your child support going to be? Are you going to move out of the house? Are you going to sell your house? You know, it's huge, major decisions all at once when somebody's in literally the worst mental state to have to make those decisions. So it's very hard for people.
Wow, that's very eye-opening. It really is.
On the settlements, I've always been curious about this because my role on the team is certified financial planner, and often I run financial plans for our clients and how retirement's going to look 20 years from now. Is there something similar that is done when a settlement is thrown out there to see if the spouse could survive on X amount of money for the rest of their life?
I think ours is kind of looking at it from the other end of that, because we have just a finite amount of what's there right now. And that's all the court will divide. So it's really a matter of just kind of saying, this is all I can get you. I don't have the luxury of saying down the line we could do this, because I have to look at just that pot of money that's right there. And sometimes it's not enough. You know, you have cases that are frankly easier to settle are the higher asset cases. The most difficult cases I find to settle are where I'm dividing debt. I mean, who wants to take the debt? So people will go into more debt fighting over hot potato. I don't want it. I don't want it. Whereas with the assets, when there's plenty to go around, those are much easier to settle. And I also find that people that have been financially responsible enough to have a lot of assets, they recognize that it doesn't make sense to spend all of their money fighting over their money. So people stop doing that. I feel like it's sometimes people that aren't as financially responsible tend to fight more over things. And it's kind of shocking because you're looking at it going, wow, there's times when I'll sit down and try to tell my client, hey, you're going to be spending almost more paying me than what you're even going to get out of this. We've got to do a cost benefit here and make sure that we're going in a path that makes sense for you, because people really get blinders on and
right.
It's emotional and they're like, I'm not giving him or her one more thing and I'm not giving up anything else. So they kind of dig their heels in. So it's my job to try to gently steer them around those roadblocks and say, look, this isn't making sense. You've got to just accept these things. It's not ideal, but it's going to get the case over and you're going to stop paying me. And you're going to have a lot more money at your disposal. So you have to have those hard conversations a lot doing this line of work.
And when a spouse or a married couple come to that sad decision where they have to divorce, would you recommend mediation, court? Is there a huge difference between the two, or is it the same thing?
You always have to file the case no matter what. And while technically you can file as an uncontested divorce, you really don't have to do that. I think you just file it as a normal divorce typically. The courts, it depends on your counties, but in Harris County, they're always going to order mediation. They always order it in Montgomery County. A couple of the outlying counties don't necessarily require it. Liberty doesn't require it. Chambers doesn't always require it. So it kind of just depends. Fort Bend usually does. So all of our counties and courts are different, but generally speaking, I would say 85% of our cases settle in mediation. So even if a county doesn't require it, I'm always trying to get my client to agree to go to mediation, because it's back to that idea we spoke about, that you have at least some control over what is happening with your own assets and debts and your own family, versus going to court is such a crapshoot because you have no idea what the judge is going to do. And when you go to trial, you lose all control of what could happen. I can prepare all day, every day, but I may go in and the judge happens to be in a bad mood, and legally I'm correct on everything and I still lose. So it is just the reality. So I try to warn my clients, because I think we get this misconception and it's America, we have the best legal system in the world, and I'm going to go in and I'm going to get something fair. There is no fairness going on in divorce court, I can tell you. Ask anyone that's been to a trial, and very few will tell you that they got what was fair out of their trial. It just isn't a thing. Family law, you're lucky to walk away with half of what you started with. No one's going to think that's fair. And so it's so much better if you can just sit down and settle your case instead of fighting it out. So I always recommend mediation in every case, even if the court doesn't require it, but most courts do. And most of our cases do get resolved that way. So you're not having to spend the extra time and money to go to trial.
Got it. And Carrie, what's one thing about you that would surprise our listeners?
So I've been nerding out lately, going down this road of like ancestry DNA and looking at my ancestry and all that, probably because I'm getting old. I just turned 50, the big 50.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congrats on the 50 club.
Join the club.
I guess it's better than the alternative. But I have been looking at all that and reading up on like ancestors and all that stuff. So it's been kind of cool. But lately, I knew this growing up, it was kind of like the folklore in the family, but I found more details. My fifth great-grandfather was James Holman, and he was the first mayor of Houston. So if you go down by U of H, there's Holman Street down there. That's my family.
Wow.
So that's my great-great-great-great-grandfather, or four greats, five greats, somewhere in there. And I love this story because one year, my grandfather was still alive. This was when my dad was young. I don't even know if I was born, so this was quite a while ago. My great-grandfather also moved to Jacksonville and was there for many years. And that's who first started our family business, which was a lumber company there in Jacksonville that went on. It actually just closed when my dad retired at 78 this year. So it was in operation for over 100 years. So he took my grandfather and my great-grandfather to Houston, and they went down to City Hall for this hanging of the portrait ceremony. And it was our relative James Holman. They were hanging his portrait in City Hall because he's one of the like founders of the city. Well, there happened to be a garbage worker strike at the same time that this was going on. So the hall was just packed with all these people. And my great-grandfather was getting up there in years, and he thought that everybody was there to see his relative's portrait being hung, and they didn't have the heart to tell him otherwise. So it's kind of a cute story. But so that's been kind of cool to read more about him. He was only mayor for a few months. Sam Houston appointed him just until they could have an election and elect the first mayor. And then he was then appointed down to Galveston, and he was the clerk of Galveston County, so like the district clerk. So you see his signature or seal is on all the old maps and plats in the area and a lot of the old documents. So it's kind of cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it's fun to read about all that.
So you're
stuff.
A true Texan.
Oh my gosh. He was in the Texian army.
Oh, wow.
And then I found out we have family in American Revolution. So we've been here a long, long, I knew we had been in Texas a long time, but I did not know we had been in America that long, on both sides, actually. So my son's going into the Army. He ships out on June 10th. And so it's been kind of neat to pull up all those old historical things and the different wars and just kind of show him, here's like the history you're carrying on. So I'm proud of him.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love hearing that. So advice, it can be our guiding light. And if you had to go back in time and give a piece of advice to your younger self, what would you tell her?
I would tell her to stop being a people pleaser. I think we women are just the worst about that, especially Southern women, because we're sort of brought up that you have to be polite, you don't disagree with anyone, you just go along to get along, you're seen and not heard, you know, all those old kind of adages. And I think, you know, it took me a long time to stop worrying so much about making someone else happy versus saying what I really needed to say. And probably, frankly, my career has made me do that, because I have to have those hard conversations with clients, and I know they don't want to hear it, and I have to say, hey, I've got to be honest about this. But thanks to my Southern charm, I've learned to say that in a way that doesn't offend people most of the time. Yeah. So it is kind of an art form, because it's not easy to give people terrible news. The worst I've had to do is look in the face of a guy that had lost a limb in Afghanistan. And I had to tell him that his wife, who was cheating on him while he was in Afghanistan, was about to get 50% of his military pension.
Oh.
And that was not a good conversation to have. And he was very upset, but I had to explain to him that's pretty much what's going to happen. Those conversations are not easy to have. I think I had a glass of wine when I got home that night because it was a rough conversation. But that's just the way it goes in this line of work. But I would stop people-pleasing for sure. That has been... Women, we got to learn to be better about that. I'm lecturing the women about that right now.
Good advice. Good advice. And the second part to that question, what's the best piece of advice that you've received and how has it influenced your journey?
I read a lot and look at a lot of stuff. So I was reading some Tony Robbins stuff and he said this quote, and it might have been Dean Graziosi. So Dean's sort of kind of Tony's protege. He's almost like taking over everything because I think Tony's, I think he's in his 70s now. He's getting on up there now. He doesn't look it, but
he looks great.
Yeah, he looks good for his age, but he's getting older. So he said that fear is just the inability to control your thoughts. And I thought, well, that's offensive to me when I first heard it. And then I was like, well, it's actually totally true. And I think what I'm learning or trying to read more about is that idea of really controlling what goes through your mind. Because we always, I think all of us do sort of this negative self-talk. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at you, you're gaining weight. Or, oh, look at you, you're this or you're that, or you're balding on top of your head or whatever it is. We're constantly kind of criticizing ourselves. Or we're constantly letting those negative thoughts kind of come. We're giving them credence. And I think that was such good advice for me because I've learned, I'm trying, it's an everyday struggle, obviously, but trying to be better about not letting those, some of the stuff I was reading was let the negative thought come through and just see it pass by like a car and put the positive thought in place and let it stop in front of you. And really trying to do visualizations of that idea so that you're not focusing on the negative thoughts as much. So I thought that was a cool quote. And it's the more I've read about that kind of stuff, it's really kind of been life-changing for me, something that I'm trying to teach my children as they're younger now. You know, they're 17 and 19, so I'm trying to teach them early instead of waiting till they're older to figure that kind of stuff out.
That's a great lesson. It reminds me, similar to a business partner that we had, may he rest in peace, the best advice he ever gave on a similar was, don't worry about things that you cannot control. And that makes a lot of sense, because what can you do about it? If you can't do anything about it, then it's just taking up space in your mind.
It's living rent-free in your mind. That's exactly right.
And in our line of work, you can't control what markets do, but you can control the risk tolerance, your time horizon, how things are structured. We don't spend that much time worrying about what the market's doing. It's going to do what it's going to do.
Well, that's right. And I think that's what I've tried to tell. Anytime I'm speaking, to younger attorneys or things of that sort, I've tried to tell them that you cannot control the outcomes of your cases by the large part, because the clients control it, the judges control it. And so some of that you've just got to let go, because that stuff will totally burn you out and it will absolutely drive you mentally crazy, because if you're trying to control everything, you will just be exhausted. It's just not something that you can do. You got to let it go and only worry about those things that you can impact.
And that's a good segue into my next question for you, Carrie. If you had the ability or the power to change one thing in your industry, in family law, what would that be?
I thought a lot about this question, and I feel like I wish there was a way to make it less adversarial. Because I don't think that most people go into the divorce initially wanting or trying to make things be adversarial. I think that a lot of people wish they could just agree and get it done. The problem is that they don't agree on getting it done in the same manner. So then it falls apart because she wants this and he wants that. But that is one thing I wish we could change, because it just makes these cases so much harder the way our system is. If you go to court over, especially in custody cases, people very much love their kids. They don't want to fight over their children, but they feel compelled to do so for whatever reasons that are maybe going on. But unfortunately, if you go to court, you are forced to sort of get in this mudslinging contest. It's just the nature of the system. And I hear judges lecture people all the time, quit fighting. And I'm thinking, you know, that's really not their fault. This is the system that they're put in. They didn't ask to be in this system. We've tried to come up with different ways for many years in the bar. We've tried to come up with, let's do this dispute resolution. Let's try to do this other non-litigation type of way to resolve cases. We found it doesn't really work. I think mediation's as good as this as we have to avoid some of those adversarial situations. But I do wish we could make it an easier process for people, a less expensive process, and make it so adversarial. But unfortunately, nobody's figured out a way to do that yet. And I don't know a way to do it either. I mean, it's something I wish I could change, not saying that I have the way to change it.
Okay. And my wife and I, we don't have kids yet, but we do have a dog. How does that get resolved in a divorce?
Oh my gosh, I bet you see that a lot,
that
right?
That has become a thing. I have kids and I have a dog, but you ask my kids, they know my dog is just like one of my children.
Yeah, my wife's saying, I'm taking a dog.
Yeah, and you're like, over my dead
body.
Have
you seen a case like that where that is like really a huge issue?
It has become a more and more common thing that people have to ask judges how to divide pets. And what's interesting with actually a lot of areas of law, the law hasn't caught up with that being an issue, much like the law hasn't caught up with how to deal with AI. The law hasn't caught up with how to deal with a lot of the technological stuff. But it has become a thing in many recent cases where they're starting to look at developing some area of law around that because it is a big deal. I mean, people's pets are their fur babies, you know, so people get upset about that. And I think one of the worst cases I had was a person, and this is public, you know, anytime I'm speaking about cases, I have to give this disclaimer, it's public record. It's cases that, you know, went to a hearing or something that was public record. But the worst case I think I saw many years ago was the person hurt the dog on purpose because they knew how much the other person loved the dog. And I was just like, oh, I'm going after that person. Like, we're taking that person down because that's just the lowest of the low. I couldn't believe somebody did that. I've seen some ugly things, but that one was pretty bad.
Jeez.
So do you think that going back to the Bezos case that his wife may have wanted the dog? He said, no, no, I'm like, you can't have that dog. And he said, I'll throw in another billion. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Hey, it wouldn't surprise me. If I had it and somebody was asking to take my dog, I would gladly pay to keep my dog. My dog is my emotional support animal. I love that dog.
What kind of dog do you have?
I have a little white fluffy dog that's a Bichon Frise and a Maltese mutt. I mean, he's just a mix. Mm. But he's so chill. And most dogs, I guess maybe it was just me growing up, but we had a couple of labs and those dogs are, I love them, but they're crazy. They're not calm most of the time until they get much older. Yeah, a lot of energy. This dog sleeps, you know, maybe 18 hours a day. He doesn't get too upset about much unless the doorbell rings or something. But he just sits there in your lap and just chills and it keeps me.
Grounds you?
Yes, he brings my blood pressure down when I get home.
Oh, that's great.
His name's Eddie.
Eddie?
Shout out to Eddie.
Shout out to Eddie.
Yeah, we have two Yorkies. My wife would definitely
fight you over.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have a chance. So looking down the road, what are some dreams that you're chasing? What are some goals that you have?
Well, I kind of have been in this, I think COVID maybe probably did this to a lot of people. You sort of reassess things and you think, wow, is this all it is? Or should I be looking at this bigger picture thing? I think that launched me into this wanting to start some other kind of business. I think partially to get out of doing such adversarial work because it does weigh on you after so many years of being in this field. So I started trying to think about ways to support people in a different way, maybe do divorce coaching or do something else. And, you know, I haven't figured out what that thing is yet, but I think it's fun to explore that. But I feel like once you get to a certain point in your career, you start looking at ways more to like give back because you feel like you've accomplished certain things, you've learned, you have something to maybe share with younger people or whatever it is. So I've thought about doing something more, either helping younger attorneys with burnout because it's so common, or doing something more on the support side with divorce, you know, divorce coaching, something similar to that. So I don't know. I think those things are still in, you know, percolating. I'm trying to figure out which direction to go with that. But I feel like there's some cool stuff that you could do that's, you know, different. But for now, I still like what I'm doing and I don't feel like I'm ready to bail out just yet. So I'm going to just keep plugging along with what's going on here.
All right. And this is the part of our podcast that we call favorites. Carrie, is there anything you're currently passionate about that you'd like to share with our listeners? Any book, movie, or piece of wisdom?
So I've been going down this rabbit hole with this. His name is Dr. Joe Dispenza. He does a lot of stuff with manifestation and affirmations. And I've been like getting in all into his stuff. So I would recommend him. He does some great just kind of meditations, things to help you just calm down at the end of the day. And a lot of the manifesting and things of that sort, because I think that's a fascinating topic. And his stuff gets very scientific in how he explains the way the mind works and the brain works. And there's all this kind of stuff. But to me, that's just interesting. So I've kind of been getting into all that stuff lately because I just find his stuff pretty fascinating. It's not something I really knew anything about. I mean, I'd heard of The Secret or whatever like years ago, but I never really knew. I mean, I knew generally, but I never really paid much attention. So that's what I've been having fun like just reading in my spare time, trying, you know, to think about something besides people fighting about their divorce.
Tell us, unless we have clients or friends are going to listen to the podcast, what's the best way if they had any questions, they wanted to get a hold of you, where can they go?
So I've got a website that has all my information on there, which is holman-firm.com. And the best way is to go on there and either get the number to text me, call me, or you can do just an inquiry on there and it'll shoot me an email. But I love texting these days, so I've been trying to segue into that. Most attorneys are scared to death to give someone their cell phone. They just don't. It is my business cell phone. It's not my personal cell phone. But I think that texting has been working well for me because I'm in court, I'm in mediation, I'm in places I can't answer the phone during the day, and they don't want to talk to my staff. They want to talk to the lawyer. So that has been a good way for me at least to be able to communicate quickly. So that's usually the best way to get a hold of me, but it's all on my website, so you can find it there. And follow me on the socials. I'm on everything, TikTok, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. I've got pages on all of those. I do tips on there. I'll do a little talk about all kinds of stuff on my pages that gives a little advice about going through a divorce or topics that commonly come up, things like that. So there's some informational stuff on some of my socials.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Do you have fun?
I had a good time, man. It's been fun.
Good. Well, again, thanks for coming in today and sharing your journey with us. And thanks to our listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Dollars and Cents. Until next time, keep embracing the wealth of knowledge, the wisdom in experience, and the well-being in your life. Signing off.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.